Do you have support from people saying, come on, you're 31. This is not the end of your life. This is just a, you know, just a bump in the road, of which there, by the way, are going to be many more because you have chronic heart disease now.
Welcome to Speak Up for Your Health. I'm your host, Dr. Arkel Giorgio, and in this podcast, I have conversations with patients about how they found their voice, figured out how to advocate for themselves, and finally, got the care they needed. Today's episode is about dreams. All of us have them. Dreams about how life will play out, what we want to achieve, and who we'll be, personally and professionally. But sometimes, life has other ideas. An illness, an injury, or a chronic condition can force you to live a life you never dreamed of. Dr. Herman Williams is a graduate of Boston University School of Medicine. He also has his MBA and master's in public health. And for the last 25 plus years, Herman has had an incredibly successful career as a senior physician executive in large healthcare organizations. But this was Herman's career path plan B. His plan A, his dream, was to become an orthopedic surgeon working with professional athletes. He was well on his way, but at the age of 31, Herman had a cardiac arrest. Herman will talk about that medical event that changed his life forever, but the real focus of this episode is how he had to advocate to create a new dream and a different future for himself. Enjoy the show. So let's start with your training. You were trained as an orthopedic surgeon, and you had this dream of being the team physician for that LA Lakers, right?
Yep.
What was that about? Tell me about that dream.
So it sounds far-fetched, but I got into Boston University School of Medicine, which at that time was a, you know, pretty, and still is, an awesome medical school nationally. I decided that orthopedics was going to be where I was going to make my focus. I met an incredible mentor, Dr. Augustus White, who was like the godfather of spinal orthopedic knowledge. He wrote the definitive book on the spine. And then I met the team doctor for the Los Angeles Rams, both who were African-American males. So not only did they sort of help me understand that it was possible because they had done it, we did it, you can do it. But I mean, I literally saw the path that I could take to get into orthopedic surgery. And then what I learned is that there was a fellowship program in the Curlin Job Clinic. And the Curlin Job Clinic took care of all of the athletes for the Kings, the Nets, the Lakers. And so, you know, people say, yeah, you want to be the, you know, team doctor. But I felt, Arkel, if I could get into an orthopedic surgery program and reconnect with my mentor at the Curlin Job Clinic, and if I got that sports medicine fellowship, someday I was going to be the team doctor for the LA Lakers. And it became so tangible for me. And that was my course.
Well, that's how most dreams come true, right? They're a really good idea with a plan. And so you were on that path. You had it all lined up. And so you were going to spend some time at that clinic in a fellowship. And after that, the path was clear. You
Correct.
Were going to be this team doctor.
I was going to do whatever it took to be the team doctor at some date, at some point. Unfortunately, 3 months after I submitted that application, my life changed.
Wow. So you were 31 years old, and what happened?
I was playing basketball. I was playing on an anesthesia basketball intramural team, and it was a showdown between the anesthesiologists and the neurosurgeons. And we were talking crap and, you know, it was going to be the game of games, which I guess it turned out because that day I died on the basketball court, literally dropped dead of a cardiac arrest. And the beauty of my life has been tragedy surrounded by a few gifts. Like, I was with four anesthesia residents who all they did all day long was resuscitate trauma patients. So they jumped on me immediately. They started CPR, and then the EMTs got there and they put the defibrillator on and they said, clear, and nothing happened. It turned out the defibrillator didn't work. So they had to resume CPR again. And then finally, a second defibrillator came, and that was where they were able to get me back into a sinus rhythm.
Oh my goodness.
So it was pretty dramatic, but at the same time, who could have figured a better anecdote to such a tragedy, but to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. I think, Herman, you can find the light in any situation, but for those who are listening, an unwitnessed cardiac arrest has a very low likelihood of having a good outcome. And so while we wish that hadn't happened to you, the fact that it was witnessed and witnessed by such experts was a blessing. How long was it until you were somewhat conscious and able to think about what had just happened?
So I think I probably lost about a week in there. And when I really sort of knew what was going on, I was being transferred to the University of Washington, which again, just happened to be one of the sites for the research for the surgically implantable defibrillator.
And this was 1991, only 11 years after the first ICD was put in place, which was in 1980. And did you have any reservations about that?
Well, I do have a little joke where the guy who sold me on this, he said, you'd have your own EMT right in your chest. You'd never have to call 911 again. And I simply asked him, well, wouldn't that hurt? And he goes, oh, no. It just feels like a strong hiccup.
Yeah. So tell us the truth about that, because you were shocked multiple times.
Oh my God. It's a crazy pain because it comes from within. And it literally, it's like getting shocked by the paddles, except it's an inner thing and it's a very noxious stimuli. It's painful. And of course, the device is so smart that literally it's evaluating you within milliseconds. So you don't know if you're going to get shocked again. You don't know, you know. And at one point, I got 25 consecutive shocks before we got to the ED.
Well, it's amazing that the shocks themselves didn't kill you.
Well, it's amazing that I didn't, do something to myself, because it is absolutely terrifying. I mean, literally, I still have PTSD. You know, if I break out into a rapid rhythm, I'll start sweating. And I mean, literally, it's still with me.
Wow. So I wanted to talk about that. You know, obviously it hurts, like you're getting kicked in the chest from the inside.
Yeah.
So it hurts physically and emotionally. You just said you had PTSD.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
You know, it's a really interesting phenomenon, because this particular type of PTSD, you know, the device is doing what it's supposed to do. It's saving your life. So you obviously, you want to accept that it's doing what it's supposed to do, but it's so noxious that you'll do whatever you can do to prevent, from getting shocked. I had a recent episode of atrial flutter, and not to get into what that is, except that it's a benign condition that is not life-threatening, but it's a rapid heart rate. And I practically lost my mind because I thought I was going to get shocked.
Yeah. Well, I was looking up some of the studies, and a very large study that was published about a year ago out of Europe looked at a collection of studies of people with ICDs and how often they have anxiety, depression, and PTSD. And the rates of anxiety and depression are about twice that in the non-ICD population. The rates of PTSD are about 10 times that. And then the other thing that this study showed is that patients' partners have a similar rate. I'm wondering if your wife experienced any of that.
My wife has PTSD also. I was celebrating having won a project literally 2 days ago. And I went, yay! And she freaked out. She goes, what happened? She thought I had gotten shot. So it literally, we both are significantly traumatized by this whole event. And the good news is, in the last 15 years, I would say maybe I've only been shocked like 3 times, right? And so over time, it dissipates. The further you get away from the last shock or the last arrhythmia, you start living a normal life. I say you start putting one foot in front of the other. But like I said, when I had that little arrhythmia episode, it immediately brought us
back. Brings it all back. Sure.
Yeah, to that moment. And I'm like, oh my God, are we going to have to do this again? So it's very powerful.
So in addition to the passage of time and just fewer shocks, thank goodness, how did you overcome the PTSD? Did you receive professional help?
Yeah, very good question. I've had numerous therapy sessions over the past 30 plus years. And I suggest that anybody who's listening to this and going, oh my God, that's me. You need therapy because you just need someone to walk you through it.
In addition to advocating for your own mental health and seeking out therapy, I want to talk about the medical care that you received. And, you know, all the stars aligned because of the world that you lived in, the profession and the training that you had, the people that were surrounding you. But did you ever find yourself, despite all those advantages, that you needed to advocate for your care, for yourself?
Yeah. Sometimes physicians don't understand the emotional component of the disease. And so they belittle, you know, they often say, look, you've got a device. What are you worried about? Well, yeah, that's what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
You know, getting the definitive treatment. Of course, I know it saves my life, but it's very painful. And I just simply ask them, have you ever been shocked? You know? I mean, and I think if you've been shocked and you understand how noxious it is, that you would maybe have a different approach. But I think all in all, if I look at it, even to this day, the care that I've received has just been incredible. It's just been outstanding. I also think you have a lot of control over how you're treated by the way you treat other people. And I've just been blessed that I let everybody know how much I appreciate being alive and having this miraculous course and have overcome so much that I think that comes back to me, you know, in triplicate. The people are like, oh my God, you know, this guy's really grateful and we're going to take the best care we can of you. And do you need anything? And I mean, so when you talk about taking accountability, I think we have a role in that as well.
You were in the hospital for 28 days.
Yeah.
And then what was the recovery like after that? Because what I'd like to transition to is the chapter of this journey where you were recovered enough to think about, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Right. I mean, you were 31, 32 years old.
Right. So I lost 35 pounds and I couldn't walk. And my wife literally had to wheel me out in a wheelchair. And so there's the emotional recovery. There's the physical recovery. You know, there's the just the mental, okay, what's next recovery. There's the professional recovery. And what I found is at that time, there were more incentives for me to, I was actually declared completely disabled. There were more incentives for me to stay disabled than for me to rehab myself.
What do you mean by that?
So there were funds that you could apply for when you become disabled. But if you regain any level of recovery, all of a sudden those funds go away. And so I imagine some people were like, well, geez, if I just stay in this state of depression and don't leave the house and don't do anything, I'll get a check every week. So I couldn't really see a bunch of incentives for why I should make myself better, except for those that I imposed on myself and those that I talked about in therapy and my family. So you have to surround yourself with people who are going to encourage you to move ahead and be your best and find something different. You got to do something different, you know? And so that's what I challenged myself with, was to create a different dream. I couldn't be a surgeon in my mind because I had literally a time bomb that could go off at any point. And you don't want to get defibrillated with a scalpel in your hand. So my surgical career in my mind was over.
Did you have to accept that? Was there a moment when you actually just had to accept it? And what was that like?
Yes, because I had to withdraw from my residency program. So what I did is I went back to business school, got an MBA, and then I pursued healthcare consulting. And I think it was the right decision, but there were other opportunities. The message to the listeners is you have to look at all of those options and not tell yourself, because this one thing I thought I was going to do didn't work out, that it's all over.
And in that path, what was the biggest obstacle that you had to overcome to be able to move forward?
The biggest obstacle was the fear to walk out of the house, because I was afraid I'd get shocked in public. And because I was getting shocked, gosh, a couple times a month. I mean, I was afraid to leave the house. I just wanted to stay inside where it was as controlled as it could be. There's so many terrible things, but there's so many blessings. I remember having a conversation with the dean of the business school, explaining my situation to her, and that, you know, I thought that business was a great option for me. Plus, it would give me 2 years of physical recovery where I was just in the classroom. And she was like, oh my God, absolutely. You're in. And so that made it easier for me to make that transition. And those 2 years allowed us to finally find the right medication to get me to be comfortable to go out and be a consultant and travel. I've traveled extensively and get comfortable, and comfortable being alone, knowing that no one's around, comfortable knowing that you're in Montana and the best cardiologists at that time are in Seattle. So you're a good plane ride away from anybody who's going to know how to deal with your condition. I mean, that took courage to get to that point. And those were the challenges I had to overcome, those fears.
Wow. So you went to business school. You've had an amazingly successful career in the industry, just in looking at the companies that you've worked for and the roles that you've had, such important leadership roles. And when I read through them and read other things that you've written in your bio and other writing that you've done, you talked about feeling that you really needed to be a patient advocate within that business role.
Yeah.
Why was that so important to you?
I think it was just finding my purpose. And what I realized is that was one of the ways to overcome the barriers, was to realize that you had a purpose. And everybody kept telling me, you know, your work's not done here, obviously, you know, I mean, but I think there's some truth to that, right? I mean, at some point you begin to say, maybe I'm here for something and I might as well advocate for the patients and the people that I can touch and make sure that we're providing high quality and make sure we're being compassionate and make sure that people understand these are real people. They're not medical record numbers, you know? And so I brought all of that to everything that I did. I even developed a kindness scale, which is in my book. And just really quickly, level one is just the most simple gesture of kindness is a smile. If you do nothing else, just smile, because it's contagious. It's almost like a domino effect. The next thing is to do simple acts of helping other people, opening a door, assisting someone with their luggage, just random acts of kindness. The third thing is using your profession to help others. So I'm an advocate for patients when they're in the hospital, because I know how important that is. If you're an attorney, you can be an advocate for people who need legal services, et cetera, et cetera. And then the fourth, the highest level of kindness and compassion, is actually donating an organ or performing CPR, of which I haven't had an organ donated, but I have had CPR performed on me multiple times that have saved my life. And so find your comfort zone at those four levels and just practice being kind. And I think that that helps people, empower people to do something very simple, because most people say, you know, the world is really screwed up and there's not much I can do about it. I think that's not true.
Do you share that kindness scale and other examples like it with physicians in your speaking?
I do. I shared it when I spoke to the electrophysiologists, and I just said to them, your patients, more than anything else, are dealing with one thing, and that's fear. And your acknowledgement of that is so reinforcing to them. They've overcome the cardiac arrest. The defibrillator is going to save their life. And they've gone from an average lifespan of 5 years to me, 30 years, right? So they've already overcome that by having a defibrillator. What they need help with is managing the stress.
One of the things I do as I advocate for patients and in this podcast is give people the words sometimes that they can use. Do you think that if patients could step up and say, you know, here's what I'm really afraid of. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that could cause a pause in the conversation with the clinician so that they could just address the fear?
Yes, I think so. And either here's what I'm afraid of, or just simply saying, doctor, I am just afraid. I'm not even sure I'm in touch with what I'm afraid of, but I'm afraid. And that changes the dynamic of the conversation.
Yeah. You haven't had a smooth ride since that initial event in 1991, so many complications that you had afterwards. And then I understand you've had three more cardiac arrests
since then.
A stroke in 2013. You couldn't speak. You had to get your voice back. And yet you continue to charge forward and you're doing even more than you were prior to that stroke. And you wrote this book, Clear, Living the Life You Didn't Dream Of. And I'm wondering, Herman, what your key takeaways are in that book that you share with others.
So I think a couple things. One is, if you find a purpose in life, it makes it so much easier to get up every morning, because you're like, I'm here to do boom. And let's get on with it. Why are we delaying? Let's do it. So that's number one. Number two, the path that you want and the path that you set upon is not always the path that you're intended to take. And that's hard. It's hard to swallow that. Okay. But I have to embrace that path, that that's the path for me, and try and do the best I can and do the most I can and the most good and the most kind that I can do on that journey. So I've accepted that, and I've accepted that responsibility. The other thing I tell people is, do you realize a million people didn't wake up today? So putting it into perspective, you take for granted that waking up is just, oh, of course I'm going to wake up. No.
Wow.
No. So understanding what a blessing it is that something so simple is really actually quite unique. If you look around the world, you look at other societies, other countries, and what they're dealing with. I mean, we don't have to get political here, but think of all the war-torn countries where waking up is a miracle because there's no food, there's no medicine, there's no hospitals. I mean, it's crazy. So we are really in a very select population of people, but even within this blessed country that we live in, and the most fortunate of many countries, still, we have people who die in their sleep. I'm sure that that weighs on my wife, you know, every morning. She looks over and is he breathing?
Making sure your chest is moving up and down. Yeah.
The other thing is, when you're dealing with these life-threatening illnesses, is to surround yourself with support and people who are going to be about supporting you and encouraging you and telling you not to give up and telling you to look at the bright side. Don't look at the negative side, because you have a choice And there are plenty of examples of other people who are worse off than me. And I tell people, you can't compare like, oh, I've got this and I don't have an arm and I don't have a leg and I have a heart transplant. I mean, you can't compare, but clearly there are people who have less opportunity than I do because they are without limbs or they can't speak or they're blind. Or so I always try and tell myself, it can always be worse.
Yeah.
You know, and so those are just some of the takeaways from the book.
Yeah. I appreciate that. You know, when we were prepping for this call, we were trying to tease out what's the takeaway theme to our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't about cardiac arrest, right?
It's
not about having a defibrillator. What we both agreed on is that the theme here is that sometimes we need to advocate for our health
mm-hmm.
to the provider system, to the nurses and the doctors and the pharmacies and the hospitals and the insurance companies. But sometimes we need to remember that we need to advocate for our health to our own selves, that we
yes.
are our biggest barrier and biggest obstacle to moving forward and enjoying the rest of the life that we have given to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're such a beautiful, beautiful example of that. And I hope that people who are listening to this podcast put that in their toolbox mm-hmm. of things that inspire them, that they remember when they face a medical issue, a health issue that's a challenge for them. So thank you so much, Herman Williams. Herman's story is a dramatic one, and you can read more about it in his book called Clear, Living the Life You Never Dreamed Of. But there are many medical situations that aren't life-threatening, but very life-altering. Like someone who dreams of being a pilot, but can't because their vision can't be corrected to 20/20. Or someone with type 1 diabetes who can't be a police officer or a firefighter. And there are so many people who desperately want to be parents, but can't because of infertility. When a condition hijacks your plan A, you might have to advocate for yourself to yourself to shift to plan B. Three key takeaways from Herman's story to keep in mind. Number one, see a therapist. This is especially important if you have depression, anxiety, or PTSD. But even if you don't, having a few sessions with a therapist or a coach can help you reimagine your future. Two, if fear is holding you back, tell your doctor and be straightforward about it because they can't read your mind. Just say something like, look, I am really, really scared, and here's what I'm afraid of. They will hear you. And depending on the situation, they might suggest additional testing, medication adjustment, or recommend extra monitoring to help put you at ease. And three, appreciate and accept support from those who are closest to you, your family, your friends, but also remember that your medical condition has an impact on them too, because being a caregiver, whether it's emotional or physical, takes a toll. Thank you so much for listening into this episode of Speak Up for Your Health. It would mean a lot to me if you could just take 30 seconds to do just two things. One, could you please follow or subscribe to Speak Up for Your Health? You can do this by going to the show page on your podcast app and pushing the follow or subscribe button that's usually on the top right-hand side of the screen. And also, could you leave a rating and review? This will help so many more people find the podcast when they're searching for something valuable to listen to. Speak Up for Your Health is produced and edited by Jenny Lee Park and myself. Music is by Alex Tepper. Cover art is by Sean Sutton. Marketing and social media is by Shelby Epstein. If you have your own story about finding your voice and advocating for yourself, share it with me. I'd love to hear it. You can email me or find me on Instagram and Facebook. The links are in the show notes. Thanks again and again for listening. I hope you let your friends and family know about this podcast. It might help them the next time they have a health issue.